All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Hello and welcome to the Read Rothbard podcast. We're running a little late. Today is our due date for posting, and we're recording it right now. What do you think of that, Robert?
Yeah, this is going to be our most timely episode ever. Normally,
right, yeah,
like
it's going to be
a week or two buffer. This one is like on the day. If you're going to get up to the
right, yeah,
news.
It's going to be like throw it in the oven, ding, it's done, post that shit.
Yeah. So there's also going to be a whole bunch of shit that happened in the past couple weeks that we probably will forget to talk about, the way it goes.
Yeah, pretty standard for us, though. I mean, we rarely have a plan anyway, so I don't see why it should be any different now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
well, hey,
touch
of the housekeeping. Real brief. So we started removing some of the older episodes from Podomatic. So now there's a little bit of room for new stuff. So if anyone is looking for old stuff, go to readrothbard.com and you'll find it there as a downloadable MP3. The other news is we are now an affiliate for the Tom Woods Liberty Classroom. And so there's a link to that from our page and also from the Facebook site. And Tom Woods put together a bunch of other Austrian and libertarian-minded professors to give courses that you don't find anywhere else in the education system as it exists today. So you get the real story behind the history of how the country was developed, what liberalism really means, whether monopolies can actually exist, if the government's good or bad. And, you know, if you're a listener of our show, you kind of know where we fall on that. But check it out. It's really good content. I've been listening to a bunch of it. Actually, on my recent trip, it felt like I had Tom with me on the trip because I was playing it on the airplane and in the car and all that. So good stuff. I definitely recommend it. And if you sign up, there's a free trial. But if you pay, then we get a little bit of money. So, hey, that's cool, right?
It is.
Yeah, so that's my little bit of housekeeping. So, Robert, what do you want to do? What do you want to talk about?
Just before we get started, I want to give a shout out to, gosh, what's the guy's name? I don't even know. Well, it's not true. I kind of knew.
Larkin Rose?
No, I know that person's name. But the guy who narrated The Most Dangerous Superstition, he's a guy that runs anarchystick.com.
Oh, okay. So it is related to Larkin.
It is?
Because that's his book.
Well, The Most Dangerous Superstition is, yeah. But, I mean, the guy that runs anarchystick.com doesn't – I don't know if they know each other.
Well, they probably know of each other, or at least Anarchy Stick knows about Larkin because he read his book.
Yes, that is very true.
Just breaking down some basic logic here. Also, one of the courses available in the Tom Woods Liberty Classroom, a course on logic. Boom.
Wow, you dropped it right there. Anyway,
I like how I blended that right in. I just stitched that right in, like, live. No post-editing, post-processing, none of that bullshit. Or did I?
Possibly no. Yeah. Anyway.
All right, continue your shout-out uninterrupted from this point on.
Yeah, so the guy's name, anyway, the guy that runs anarchystick.com. It's a fairly recent site, so it doesn't have a whole lot of content, but he's got The Most Dangerous Superstition broken down into chunks. But then you can also get the whole thing over at niceaudiobooks.blogspot.com. And if you just do a search for The Most Dangerous Superstition, you should find a link. You could also download it by chapter, but the whole audio file is there. It's around, I want to say it's like around 300 megabytes. And it's really good. He mispronounces a couple words, like, but not so that it totally discredits. At least maybe he's just from a different part of the country, and that's how they say those words. I don't know, but just listening to it every once in a while, I go, no, you mean something else when you said that. But, yeah, it's really good. I recommend everybody to listen to it. It's about 10 hours and 15 minutes of pure anarchic argumentation. Larkin tends to, like, kind of say the same thing over and over again, but just slightly differently. So if you just listen to it in one giant binge, you might go, okay, we get it. But he really has some different nuanced arguments. So he does kind of tackle you know, different questions they just have. Actually, if you've been following him on steemit.com lately, he's really been, I don't know how to say that he isn't creating new content. He does, but he's actually been mining his own book for different Steemit posts. He's turned it into quite a bit of cash, so good for him. Anyway, that's my shout.
Yeah. So tell me more about The Most Dangerous Superstition, because we kind of jumped the gun on the audience here by talking about the guy who narrates it. So let's back up. What's the book about? Just real generally, like other
okay.
than just
okay.
anarchy argumentation.
So it's, heavily inspired.
When did you first hear about it?
What?
When did you first hear about it, and when did you first read it?
When did I first hear about it? That's going back in the day. I think my buddy Daniel mentioned it years and years and years ago, and he would always, you know, say, hey, every time he'd see me, he'd be like, so, did you read that Most Dangerous Superstition? And at the time, I kind of like read the first chapter and go, yeah, I know all this. I've heard all these arguments. These are fine. I am totally in agreement with all this crap. I don't see the need to read this book, to sit down and read it. And so my buddy Dan would give me shit every time. And as anybody, well, I don't know if anybody knows, but I'm a huge fan of Mark and Rose's work. Some of his first videos on YouTube were some of the first things that, like, I'm Allowed to Rob You, The Tiny Dot, I think it was called. Then there's one about being a king. All super, super good. If you haven't seen those videos, check them out.
Yeah, we'll
but
put links down
so
below.
I was with his arguments that the book seemed kind of redundant to me. So then finally, so I'd never actually read it. Never. Never actually read the whole thing. I'd read, you know, like the first chapter or two and then set it down. And so finally, listening to the audio book, I just pretty much just binged it over the course of a couple of days. So really, this is the first time I've actually heard the whole thing, and I've never actually read it. So if that'll answer your question for me.
All right. Well, I'm just interested in the why you think it's important enough to talk about, because you're throwing your authority behind it. Now, use that word advisedly, but like you're giving your approval of this and you're recommending it. So,
well,
I recommend it. Why?
Well, because property, you know, doesn't exist and shouldn't exist, and nobody should ever own any property. And The Most Dangerous Superstition is all about the myth of property, and it's really inspired by the Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx. And Larkin's a big fan. And it's also inspired by a lot of, like, the Constitution of the United States and how government's awesome sauce. And, yeah, just really, really good arguments in there. I don't know what to say about it. It's one of the foundational documents of anarchism. Anarcho-communists seem to think that anarcho-capitalists aren't true capitalists. And anarcho-capitalists seem to think that anarcho-communists aren't true communists, or aren't true anarchists. So I don't know if you could call it a foundational document of anarchism, because it isn't. I mean, it's way later. I mean, he wrote it in, like, the 90s or the early 2000s. But it is, I don't know, man, it's just one of those foundational texts, I think, along with, you know, Mises and Rothbard and Spooner and Locke and all those things, and maybe Hazlitt and those kind of things. It's more, it doesn't approach it, anarchism, from an economic angle, but it very much approaches it from a moral angle, and approaches it from a logic angle, and how it's just insane for the entire idea of government is just insane. The idea that you could give a right that you don't have, that you could vote power to other people, over to dominate other people. I'm butchering it horribly, which is fine. Maybe it'll inspire people to actually listen to the arguments themselves, I don't know. I listened to the whole thing, and I found, you know, very few things that I disagreed with. Very few things. I mean, there's no one book that you're going to completely agree with entirely, but I don't know. It's all super good, super good. Highly recommended. I know you're not a fan, but that's fine. Maybe I'll convince you someday.
So a fair amount of jest in that. I think. Are you saying that inspired by the Communist Manifesto and Marx and the Constitution, in that he tears them apart?
You would have to wait and see. Spoiler alert. Jeez, Daniel.
Well, you do recall I have read the book, and I'm a fan of Mr. Rose, of course.
Oh, so you know Ben.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. He talked about the myth of authority and the Milgram experiments, where people would listen to somebody who represented authority simply by carrying a clipboard around and wearing a lab coat, and they would go to the point of murder of their fellow human, or at least thinking that they were murdering someone else, just because somebody in a lab coat told them to do it, which is crazy indeed.
And he also brings up the Stanford Prison Experiment, where they had to cut it short because they just arbitrarily picked, you know, one student to be a guard and another student to be a prisoner, and they divided them up that way, you know, just randomly. But after a very short amount of time, the guards were just abusing the prisoners, like, so ridiculously, they had to cut it short.
Yeah, I remember reading about that one in college, and they don't really take it to the direction that Larkin does, where, well, obviously you can't assign power over others because it breeds this type of, you know, abuse of that power. You know, in school it was more like, you know, if you put people in this position, then bad things happen or whatever, but and they had shut down the experiment or whatever. It was Philip Zimbardo, I think, was the professor at Stanford. He wrote a couple of books about it. But yeah, how Larkin takes those two examples as, you know, like proof positive why you can't have an authority because then bad shit happens. But then you're right. He does talk about the logical end of it where he asks the question, if you, Robert, don't have the moral authority or ability to do something, and I, Daniel, don't have that same moral authority or ability to do something, then how can we transfer that to someone else? How can we give someone else the ability to morally justify what they're doing? Like, even if a million of us voted for it, or a billion of us, if you or I don't have that right, then it doesn't matter how many of us who don't have that right try to bestow it upon another.
Indeed. So, yeah, just the entire myth of authority, the insanity of democracy,
yeah,
the insanity of creating rights that is out of thin air. Just, hey, we're a bunch of guys, and we're going to all get together and decide that it's okay for us to rob you. And just the whole schizophrenic nature of documents like the U.S. Constitution, where on the one hand they'll grant that slavery is illegal, and then they'll grant that, you know, Congress can't do X, Y, and Z, but then they'll say, oh, but we're allowed to rob you in the same breath. So it's...
Yeah, a lot of dissonance there.
Yeah. It's complete tone deafness, which is not surprising if you've ever listened to a politician. Obama came out and decried that Trump had taken a bunch of money from a charity and used it to build a statue or something like that. And I was just like, yeah, it's ridiculous when someone takes your money and then spends it in a way you don't approve of. Can you imagine how frustrating that would be? So, I mean, politicians are constantly, they don't have actually principles. They just, they listen to opinion polls and they don't answer the question that you asked. They answer the question that they wanted you to ask. And, so anyway, Larkin really takes the piss out of all of that, just exposes the insanity for what it is.
And, right, like writing it down on a piece of paper doesn't change the fact that it's wrong, or some mystical ceremony, like such as voting or things like that, don't change the morality of the situation.
Right.
So,
and
all in
democracy, for all its vaunted, wonderful contribution to humanity, supposedly, is really just gang rape in action. It's the majority deciding what the minority is going to have to do with the gun in their head. And he talks about, you know, anytime you say there ought to be a law for that, well, are you prepared for someone to be killed? If you take it to the logical conclusion, that's exactly what law is. So, anyway.
Right, yeah. And I think you've been having some discussions with some folks who are on the other side of the arguments here, because you've been sending me some fired up stuff lately. So is that something you want to approach on our call? We don't need to name any names, but you want to maybe talk about some of the frustrations you're experiencing there?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a guy that I'm a big fan of, good friend of mine, that we've been talking with, who has been arguing, first of all, who knows what he actually believes, because he loves to just argue the other side. He plays devil's advocate really, really well. But he also comes up with these ridiculous situations that, you know, are all excuses of why people can't be free, why we need to be dominated and controlled. And they're really kind of frustrating, but also a little bit get annoying, because he seems to believe that when we move to an anarchic world, all the rules of society and human interaction just get thrown out the window. So one of his complaints is, well, under an anarchic society, there's no law, right? There's no top-down authority. So you could just go pissing and shitting all over the place and throwing your garbage everywhere, and as if there would be no natural consequences to those things. As if there wouldn't be your wife, like, why are you shitting on the couch? Why are you pissing all over the place? This house stinks. I'm leaving, your dumbass. Who would want to invite that guy to any party, to have him over to his house ever. Why would I invite this guy that's just shitting all over the place to my house? You would quickly run out of friends. You would piss everybody off. And human beings are social creatures. We actually go to great lengths to avoid conflict. It makes people uncomfortable. It makes people not like you. It's also very dangerous. It can be very dangerous to upset people to a great deal. And if you were to go over and shit on somebody's brand new carpet, I'm sure they would get upset and they wouldn't want to spend time with you anymore, at the very least. And everybody would be talking about you behind your back. People would be staring at you. I mean, can you imagine? And the nagging you would get from your friends and family. Like, what are you doing, man? What the hell are you doing? So,
you'd be self-imposing ostracism, which I think, as we've discussed in the past, is one of the most effective punishments out there. You know, people will choose to not associate with you, and you're right, we are social animals. So if you are behaving in a certain way and people don't like it, then, you know, you're bringing that punishment upon yourself and no one will want to be around you.
Right. And that is, and as much as that isn't a gun in your face, that is an equally effective, in my opinion, punishment. Because you're self-ostracizing yourself. You are putting yourself in a box that nobody else wants to be in, and you're going to be a very lonely person. We know how powerful ostracism is. We discussed in this past, so I'll mention it again quickly. People will stay in cults long after they've figured it out that it's total bullshit, just for the social interaction, just for the friendships and the community feeling that they have. Now, if you were to go around pissing and shitting all over everything and pissing everybody off around you because there's no quote-unquote law preventing you from doing a thing, you'd quickly get massive societal backlash, massive community backlash to your actions. It's nonsense, and it's a really strange argument to make against the idea of freedom, because just because there isn't a gun in your face doesn't mean there isn't consequences to your actions at all times.
Right, and then if the actions that you're perpetrating are in violation of the non-aggression principle, then those repercussions can be violence, you know?
Sure.
If someone is defending themselves, then violence is certainly at times justified. You know, obviously case-by-case business, or situation, but it sounds like some of the arguments that you're getting from this person assume that violence is only used for offensive and domination purposes, and he just throws out the window any case of justifiable self-defense.
Yeah. So it's been frustrating.
As if people would not defend themselves.
Right. You have to, another one of his arguments is that, you know, as soon as there are no laws, then instantly warlords will just pop up and start taking over everybody. When in reality, anybody who's going to just go around using violence is going to suffer a massive market disadvantage. And who's going to want to do business with somebody if you know they're just some violent, crazy person?
Right, and you're talking about in Libertopia, right? Like,
sure.
In today's society, this reminds me of that tweet I sent you, the screenshot of. What did it say? It was from Michael Malice. Do you have it in front of you, or do you remember what it said?
He goes, if these jihadis just want to go around killing people indiscriminately, why don't they just run for office like a normal person?
Exactly, right?
It's gold.
I mean, that's essentially what our friend is arguing that is a problem with Libertopia, but happens every day today.
Right. And he doesn't also acknowledge the idea that, claim that, like, the mafia will just take over. Well, the mafia exists where some activity or, you know, some voluntary activity or some product has been just deemed illegal. So the mafia runs drugs, prostitution, gambling, that sort of thing, alcohol, pretty much created by government. They don't, you know, they run the black markets. In Libertopia, these things would all be legal. So what would their mafia be? The mafia is essentially violent because they have no access to the courts. They can't call the cops when, you know, they're attacked or whatever. They have some issues they need to deal with. You can't sue somebody that, you know, whatever, for what, you know, for some, you know, illegal deal that you just did. So by very nature, since they're, you know, legal options, quote unquote legal options, are denied to them, they are essentially forced to, you know, establish, you know, their own justice or what have you. I'm not defending mafia violence, but you got to admit that they are essentially a creation of government. And it seems to be that most people who complain about almost everything in the world give government a pass and blame the reaction to government by people just trying to survive in the free market. Now, obviously the violence of mafia is horrible, but I was recently trying to watch a movie called The Corporation, which is this massive, like, trendy, you know, Michael Moore type documentary that seems to have zero understanding of economics. In it, it complains about sweatshops as if the argument, and Woods has mentioned this recently, as if the argument is between, you know, working and just going to school and just being a kid running around. But no, the choice is between working and starving. It's not that the parents of these kids want them to just work to death. They have to just survive. So it whines about that. It whines about basically the power of corporations, which is a good good thing to complain about, the fact that they have limited liability, the fact that they are treated as a person or what have you, the fact that they can essentially be super risky and suffer no effect of that risk. So they can make these massive risks, and then their personal possessions, you know, the personal income is not at stake, or not at risk. And that's all protected by government fiat and violence. So it's not that corporations are necessarily, well, companies are necessarily evil, but when you've got these government protections, that's where the problem comes in, and nobody seems to identify that. At least the movie doesn't, that's for damn sure.
Yeah, well, if I can take it back just a couple of steps,
yep.
You were talking about how the mafia can't appeal to government to solve their problems for them.
Right.
Would you say that that's one of the key differences between the mafia or gangs and government itself? Because I think you could make the argument that they behave in very, very similar fashions, right?
Sure. They make their own rules and not, yeah, I would say that.
Yeah, and you don't really have a choice whether you're their customer or not. They demand payment or they'll break your kneecaps or whatever.
Oh, sure, like a protection racket? Absolutely, yeah. Government is absolutely a very successful protection racket. Well, they'll just walk into your local deli and say, hey, looks like you could do some protection.
From who? From us.
From us. So, yeah, you better pay up. And we'll protect you from all those other guys that are secretly out to get you for some reason.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you look at it from, like, the Larkin viewpoint, you know, what they're engaging in their unwarranted authority, where they try to make the immoral moral by having laws and magic ceremonies about it, they're essentially committing crimes, right, against what could be considered natural law or violations of the non-aggression principle. And so, in effect, they are organized crime, and hence no different than the mafia.
Completely and then agree.
The other point I wanted to make was that you were saying the mafia exists because certain enterprises are illegal, and therefore they're open for control by a mafia organization. I would also argue that the drug trade and gangland violence in inner cities is also related to that. Like, if there weren't prohibitions on drugs, then where would gangs and things like develop from? You know, if you could just go and buy drugs, whatever you wanted, whenever you wanted, like from Amazon or wherever.
Or the Silk Road before you got thrown in jail for life.
Right. But, you know, what turf would anyone control, you know? Like, what violence would be incited from that? And beyond that, and we've touched on this before, we haven't really dug into it, but the reason that so many of these people are attracted to this situation is because other opportunities are not afforded to them because of such progressive policies that are intended to, quote-unquote, help them, actually harm them. And makes it harder and harder for them, for people with lower skills or in certain areas, to be employed, you know, because the costs to employ them are too high versus the value that they bring to the job.
Right. You're talking about the minimum wage laws. And I would also add the whole idea that the war on drugs has also horrifically been applied. I mean, you've got, like, what is it, like 60 or 70% of people in prison today that are in jail for nonviolent drug offenses?
Yeah, I think Anarchy Ball said it was
80%. When you're a criminal, now it's, like, illegal for you to own a gun. It's much harder for you to actually get a legitimate job, in addition to the huge barrier of entry of the minimum wage. And so what are your options? You can get on the dole, get in the welfare state, and you can pretty much sell drugs. And drugs are super lucrative because, they've been made illegal, hence they've artificially constricted the supply and turned it into a very lucrative business.
Right, so they've effectively artificially generated an excess supply of affordable labor or of people looking for work, looking for some way to get by. Mm-hmm. You know, if you shut off their avenue of being able to get jobs, and then you provide a shortage in some other area that drives up the demand for something and hence the price, so it's worth the risk. You know, so it's like a no-brainer to join a gang and start slinging drugs.
Right.
Like, you'd be foolish not to.
Yeah. What are your options? I mean, at that point, what are your options? Like you're saying, it's foolish enough. You can go into the military, or you can sell drugs, or you could, like, work at McDonald's or be on
right.
the dole.
You know, and you brought up the sweatshop thing. In my mind, this is far worse than a sweatshop, you know, and that's what liberals are upset about, are sweatshops. But this is far, far worse, because this is somebody, some entity taking away opportunity and then only leaving left behind something that's dangerous and allows that same entity to persecute them. You know, a sweatshop is there because the labor is a lower price and they can manufacture their goods at a lower price and hence sell it to people at a better price so that they have money for other things. You know, it improves the standard of living for everybody. But this prohibition on drugs and this push towards engaging in that kind of activity and removing opportunities through the minimum wage and similar legislation is completely opposite. It's taking away opportunity.
And never mind the hypocrisy. And Larkin gets into this in his book, The Most Dangerous Superstition. The hypocrisy of a cop going out and busting someone for having marijuana. And then after the bus is over and he goes home and he cracks open a beer. I mean, you're talking about two mind-altering substances. One is just arbitrarily made illegal. You classify these drugs. It's just a smattering of what's illegal, what's not. Who knows? The pharmacology in the world is so complicated. There are literally thousands of drugs. And it seems to be this roulette wheel that deems this is really bad for you. Oh, no, this is good for you. None of it's motivated by any kind of principle in any way whatsoever. So the sheer insanity of it all, well, the sheer insanity of government, it makes no sense. It's just completely arbitrary. It's just reaction, problem, reaction, solution. Governments and politicians are purely like, when they're not busy out making new laws and repressing people, they are reactionary, and they will just listen to what people want, essentially, and people whine and want something made illegal to the government. And they'll go ahead and do that, and they have no qualms about violating and attacking people. And apparently, the citizens of the country don't seem to care either. And hopefully, if people listen to things that we have to say and people like us have to say, they'll realize that when you make something illegal, you're essentially signing somebody's death warrant, or at least potentially signing someone's death warrant. And so, do you feel good about that? Do you really want something to be that illegal? Does it really affect your life that much? Or is it something that somebody else is choosing to do freely? It just pisses you off or something like that.
Yeah, well, you're certainly putting more people at risk by having more and more of these laws. And I think there's at least, 10 or a dozen felonies that people commit every day in their everyday life just because there's so many different laws out there that cover so many things, and they're so contradictory and overlap and conflict with each other.
Arbitrarily imposed and enforced, absolutely.
Yeah. How can you ever know whether you're doing something wrong or right, you know, unless you appeal to a certain objective, you know, rule, which is something like the non-aggression principle, where you're basically not initiating violence, it's okay.
Yeah, and I've seen arguments against the NAP that are like, they go something like, well, how would you expect everybody even understand the NAP and blah, blah, blah. It's like, are you kidding me? The NAP is what, like one sentence? How many freaking thousands of pages of rules and regulations and laws are in this country?
Yeah, really something like 80,000.
Basically the golden rule. So don't give me that excuse.
Yeah, indeed. So we've been rambling already. Did we want to make this about the movie you mentioned, or do we want to move on to some other focal point?
No, we don't need to talk about that Corporation movie. Terrible.
Yeah, I saw it probably 5 or 6 years ago, and at the time, you know, I was still in the searching stage, and so I was like, oh, yeah, corporations is bad, evil, you know? Yeah, they're fucking up our air and our water, and they're GMOs and Monsanto and shit.
And there are some legitimate, you know, reasons, but it's almost always due to interactions or caused by government as the ultimate cause.
Right.
People are constantly whining about, you know, governments or corporations need to supply X, Y, or Z, like, you know, like you've said this in the past. You talked about in the past with 401ks and that sort of thing, like certain benefits packages that people will say corporations have to supply. And it's all through violent government fiat. I mean, get out of the marketplace. And I don't really know where I'm going with this. Anyway.
Well, what I think you were saying was that those things in the past, the 401ks developed to counteract a previous government intervention in the marketplace. And so companies trying to get around these restrictions on like salary that they could pay people. Like, there were limits on what you could pay people. So they developed these things called 401ks, which were alternative ways of competing for labor. You know, hey, I want you to come work over here, but I can't pay you any more than them because of this stupid rule. But I can provide you this retirement package. And that's how healthcare benefits became associated with employment and a myriad of other things. And so now, as time goes on, they become familiar and expected. And then eventually, once they become onerous and difficult to maintain, they become mandatory through government fiat. So it's so fucking crazy, right?
Right. So in the initial, they were used as a tool to get around some stupid government regulation. And then government comes along and says, oh, no, now you have to supply this thing.
Yeah, they co-opt the reaction to their own problem they've created. It's crazy.
Yeah. But let's move on to this main thing we're talking about here. I'm basically going to interview you because I didn't get to see it. You recently got to see the Snowden movie about the real-life person Edward Snowden, who is currently hiding in Russia, who is a NSA whistleblower. And why don't you tell me how the plot of the movie goes before we get into any kind of like analysis or review kind of thing?
Yeah, certainly. So I just want to throw out there as a preface that the only reason I could go out and see a movie at all, because I've got two kids at home, is I was out on a business trip. And so I had a free evening and was able to go see this movie. So good timing on that. But essentially, it's Oliver Stone's the director, and he takes the story of Snowden in the hotel room in Hong Kong, where he's divulging the information to Glenn Greenwald and a documentary filmmaker to break out kind of flashbacks. So he would go on day one and show him, you know, meeting in the hotel room, and they go, all right, tell us about yourself. And then, you know, flashback to him growing up and, or, you know, joining the military and going through basic training and all this stuff. And, you know, being super patriotic and wanting to serve his country and all these things as a result of 9/11. Cause you know, at the time he bought into the narrative that, you know, we were attacked and we need to protect ourselves as a country, like us, quote unquote us. So, you know, he goes into it with these intentions to be a patriotic person. But then it keeps flashing, you know, back and then forward in time again, where different developments kind of happen along in the story. But essentially over time, he starts gaining more and more awareness of activities that he knows are not legitimate, that are openly illegal. He sees members of the intelligence community lying under oath about their collection practices. And finally, it dawns on him that he has the ability to gather a bunch of this information and then try to expose it so that people can ultimately make the decision on whether they think this is okay or not.
And spoiler alert, pretty much nobody cares.
You know, it does seem to be that way. I think with the release of the film, there's a renewed interest in his story. And I think that when it first was happening, they kind of brilliantly dropped the news stories because they would sort of force the government to react and deny. And then the very next day, they would release a story that totally refutes what the government just said. So that was a brilliant thing that they did with how they planned it. I'm sure that's a credit to Greenwald as a guardian. But yeah, it does seem like nobody really cares anymore. Like, it's old news, you know. Oh, that was 3-4 years ago now.
Yeah, I guess they did some poll where I guess only 2/3 of Americans could recognize him or knew who he was, and then only about 1/3 thought he did a good thing. I guess there's a big sentiment of people, or a large segment of people, who still think he's a spy and he did terrible things and he exposed us to X, Y, and Z. He's compromised, you know, all these legitimate programs that are super cool, and there's, you know, the NSA and the government would never do anything intentionally bad, and would never spy on its own citizens without, you know, like court order and, you know, super just cause, and they're only going after the bad guys and the terrorists, right?
Right. Yeah. It's funny how they'll assign like these noble intentions to government, like you were saying, give them a free pass. But then every time there's an election season, they're at each other's throats. Like, you know, people are like not debating, but throwing, you know, sound bites at each other. Like, your guy's a criminal. Your person sucks. They belong in jail. Oh, they did this. They did that. Congress's approval rating is like 6%. You know, all this stuff, like how terrible and dysfunctional and broken everything is. But then when you see examples of them obviously overreaching, you know, undeniable, incontrovertible evidence of them abusing their power, blatantly breaking the laws that they have themselves intended to constrain themselves, and people just give it a pass.
Right. And then, as Larkin would point out, he would not be surprised in any way, because why would a ruler ever limit to themselves by something one of the ruled would say? I mean, it just wouldn't make sense, or else you wouldn't be a ruler if you were limited by, you know, the desires of those you rule. So get into, as far as you know, maybe like the accuracy of the movie, or some of the actual, you know, like revelations that you had in the movie.
Well, the accuracy and the veracity of it, I'm not super aware of. I'm sure that some creative license had to be made to like try to, you know, bring some sense of drama to it. And I'm sure that they left out things that may have been deemed important by some people. I mean, it's like a 2+ hour movie, but you know, his life has been 32 years and the events covered are like almost 10 years. So, you know, doing that in 2 hours doesn't really leave a lot of room for everything.
It's also worth mentioning that they had a big time or a hard time financing this movie. None of the major studios would want to touch this because A, it's during an election year, B, the volatile nature, you know, the anti-government type of nature of the content. So, and it's also this movie is not doing very well financially. Who knows if they're going to make their money back, but apparently it only made like $8 million on its first weekend. So, it's getting crushed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, actually,
well, they got my $15.
What's that?
They got my $15.
There you go. So what were some of the abuses that are highlighted in this movie that you could point at and go, look at this, this is obviously criminal?
Well, like one of the revelations that kind of dawned on him at the time was he's assigned to like look into like this banker from Syria or whatever, and he tries to befriend the guy, and then he tries to find some points of leverage so that he can, you know, get information out of him. And so they go to their spy headquarters, whatever, and some other technician is showing him all this stuff that he can pull up, you know, and he's like, oh, you mean like their emails and things that they posted somewhere? And he's like, no, man, this is like live. Like I can just look at, you know, anyone's computer, turn on the camera, listen to their phone call, see where they posted this. We got all this keyword search software. If they said these certain words, then it pulls up, you know, and just, you know, kind of dawns on him the awareness that this can be used on anybody at any time. And it's all archived and, you know, goes back. So, you know, if you ever get on their list, they can find out anything, essentially. And, you know, that I think is portrayed as an overreach and just in his mind on what their mission is supposed to be, like what their stated goal or whatever it is supposed to be. But then they talk about, you know, the authorizations that were given after 9/11 was to intercept communications internationally or by non-U.S. citizens. But then they stumble into some, I guess, aggregations of the data, which shows by which country they've gathered certain amounts of information. And he notices that the United States, they've gathered more information internally than they did even on Russia. And so that was like a big, like, well, the guy just said we don't do this, and here we've got more, way more domestic stuff than on countries that are supposedly on this, like, watch list.
Mm. So shockingly, they were lying, as usual.
Yeah,
and
shockingly.
All these self-imposed limits are bullshit, as usual.
Yeah, you know, they've got a couple of live clips of the testimonies and campaign promises by Obama. And he, in the movie, he says, you know, when Obama was getting elected, I had hope that he would rein things back in. And so I hadn't decided yet whether I was going to move forward with revealing any of this stuff or not. But then the same things just continue to happen or be expanded upon. You know, so it's another example of those campaign promises that just get broken the moment the power is attained, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I would say that it's not necessarily an anti-government movie. I think that was one of the things that you had mentioned in one of our previous shows where, you know, like, hey, maybe they're going to point the NSA or the CIA as kind of this bad rogue portion of the organization. And in a way, they kind of do that. I think that Oliver Stone tries to be, you know, patriotic and protect and uphold the Constitution, you know, and so he throws in those scenes with Snowden in the military and, you know, how he's like, rah-rah, you know, it's be America, blah, blah, blah. But because it's so you know, all encompassing. I mean, it's not just those arms of government, but all the way up to the president. So in a way, you know, it's like there's all these bad actors. They're certainly not questioning, like Larkin would, or like the non-aggression principle would imply, or Murray would, the legitimacy of government to begin with.
So would you say that the villain of the movie is what? The lack of accountability by the people, or the creation of these, like the Patriot Act or whatever, or, I mean, what would you say is the takeaway from the movie?
Well, I think that the point of it was to raise the awareness that this is happening, and then the accountability of the people can be brought to bear. So I don't think that they would say that it's a lack of accountability, because the people aren't aware of it. So how could they hold them accountable? But now that they're being made aware, then comes the true test of, okay, what are you guys going to do about it?
I don't know about that. I mean, this is all public stuff that happened years ago, and nobody seemed to give a shit then. I mean, pop culture has a way of reigniting interest in a thing. I would say that, you know, when JFK came out, it reignited a lot of interest in that. But I don't know, man.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of people will go back to the standard trope of, well, I don't have anything to hide, so it's fine. You know, I'll be in the panopticon.
Right. When that's exactly an idiotic argument, because clearly you don't actually have to have done anything wrong for this to get turned on, for the Eye of Mordor to get turned on you.
Right, yeah. Like we said a moment ago, you know, everyone most likely commits 10 felonies a day. Well, you're not aware of that fact. So it really comes down to, all right, if they, for whatever reason, decide to look in your direction with this thing, then they'll just count how many felonies you did yesterday, and there you go.
Right, and in the past in history, you know, political dissidents and opponents have always been arrested and murdered. If you go back to Hitler and Stalin, I mean, those guys.
Or Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, Lincoln
put
constantly imprisoning
people in prison who are critical of the war.
Right. And they would,
so did Wilson.
You know, due process or whatever, come up with some bullshit reason. So you don't have to be guilty of anything. All you have to do is be unpopular or not supportive, or maybe your Sesame score is too low, or your Patriot points you don't have enough of.
Yeah.
And you could instantly find yourself in Guantanamo with no due process and going, but I was a good little slave. What happened? I don't understand. Can someone contact Mr. Obama or whoever the figurehead mafia thug is in charge?
Yeah. You know, I think overall it was a good movie to see. At the beginning, there's a little warning from Oliver Stone, you know, how sometimes before movies they'll say, hey, turn off your phones or whatever. But he says it in effect that, hey, what you're about to see is all about how they can use this little device in your pocket to spy on your every move. And I ask that during the duration of the film, you turn your phone off, like power it down, remove the battery if you can, that kind of a thing. I mean, he almost sounds like I'm sure some people would say crazy pants, you know, like I'm sure some of the hit piece reviews have called him out on that, like being paranoid. But the whole film is basically, you know, supporting, yeah, this shit happens. You know, it's not paranoid.
Yeah, and there have been stories of people, who will, famous people, who will, you know, cover their video camera on their laptop with a piece of tape or something.
Yeah, Zuckerberg does that.
It's a reasonable precaution to do in this day and age.
Yeah.
And that's the leap of it. I mean, they could, like you said, they could just dig into your files on your computer, search for anything they want without any kind of oversight. And, you know, as if even if they did have oversight, it would be somehow legitimate.
Yeah. Now, I will say that there is a HBO documentary that came out, a year or two ago called Citizen 4, which is the actual documentary film that the person who met with him in the hotel room made. And that is actually Snowden in the actual events, in the actual time and place, speaking about what his intentions are, what he's worried about, what they're trying to do. And that's something that I think would be a nice complimentary piece to this film, so you can kind of compare and contrast what's presented in the movie in a sort of stylized way and see what creative license they've taken and compare that to or contrast it to what the actual events were that are presented in the documentary. Again, you know, 5-6 days of filming down to 2 hours. So, you know, certain things didn't make it, of course.
Right.
And I'll post a link to that down below because I think at least at the time of this recording, you can rent Citizen 4 from Amazon for, I think, $1. So if you want to watch it, you have 30 days to watch it from when you try to rent it, and Once you start watching, you've got to watch it within 48 hours. So I've done that. I haven't watched it yet, but I will. And we might make 6 cents if you rent it through our link.
Ooh.
Or maybe 4 cents.
Is that something that's free on Prime or no?
No, not free on Prime. It's a Amazon Video rental, 99 cents.
Okay. All right, so let's get into a little bit of just the standard movie kind of review, if you don't mind. If you could tell me how old Oliver Stone tells the story, how his directing was, you know, how the acting was, all that business.
You know, it seemed pretty good. It's got Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and he's a decent actor as it is. You know, he's been in like Inception and things like that, and I find that he's entertaining to watch. They voice coached him or whatever to have this really low voice, and it's a bit it's probably a bit much, especially if you actually hear Snowden speak. He doesn't actually talk like that as much, and they actually show Snowden at the end of the film speaking about the events that happened that inspired the film, and so that's kind of cool to see, because I mean, it obviously happened with Oliver Stone recording or being there. You know, it's like this moment is based on the movie being made, and so to see Snowden like still alive and being able to be at the end of the film is kind of cool.
Sure. Yeah. I think there was a John Oliver interview where he actually interviewed Snowden. He went to Moscow, and Snowden showed up to some hotel room across from like the old Kremlin or something like that.
Yeah, I remember seeing that and thinking that, you know, as much as I dislike this guy, John Oliver, he didn't do half bad with Snowden.
Right. Yeah.
I think it's one of those things that people of the left, on the left, will see in him a heroic act, where more military pro-cop type, pro quote-unquote law and order types will see him as a traitor or a spy. And so that's kind of a weird situation for me personally, just because I used to identify with the left, and now being a hardcore anarcho-capitalist libertarian, small L, I line up more and more on a conservative take on most things, just in general, though I would not label myself a conservative at all. But on this issue, I think that Snowden did, you know, absolutely the right thing. Like, if the government that's creating these laws is violating their own laws meant to restrain them, like they do every day, read the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. They violate every single one of those things every day, all day long, and they're intended to constrain the government. And they have, this is a staff argument, they have created the largest, most powerful, most threatening in the history of the world government that has ever existed.
Right. So, yeah, shockingly enough, authoritarians aren't bounded by pieces of paper. Crazy enough.
Yeah. So I don't know if what I just said made any sense. It felt like it did at the time, but I'll have to listen to it again.
Is there any kind of situation? I know there's like a dramatic in the trailer. There's a dramatic scene where Snowden kind of like copies a bunch of data and absconds with it and makes it through like a security checkpoint and whatnot. At any point in time, did you see that as, like, in regards to the NAP, like, as theft? Or do you say that he's acting in self-defense or in defense of another? Any kind of analysis on that line?
Well, that's an interesting question because, did he steal something? And, well, if it's, to borrow the line from In Time, is it stealing if you're taking it back, something that's already been stolen? You know, so were they the legitimate owners of the information? And
so
I would argue
exactly
no.
Did he steal then? Because all I remember, all I've seen is the trailer, and all I see is a little jump drive that he hides in some sort of a thing.
You know, I think it's slide decks about what their capabilities are with certain systems, what they're intended to do, how they interact with the internet, and how they siphon it off. It's not really made super clear, but. They do make it come down to a single event where he's downloading this stuff onto his computer and like, or onto this drive, and like 35 windows pop up, and then they, you know, each one like counts down until it's fully transferred, and then they close. And so they make it all dramatic. He's got 35 windows and someone's walking towards him. And the last one closes just as the person gets there, which is so fucking ridiculous because, you know, they put up something else in front of it or whatever, you know, like what would you normally do?
Yeah, well, it's just like his normal workstation, right? It's not like he had to break into the Death Star and do something like that, right?
Well, he was in the movie in a very highly secure area that no one else, I mean, it was his work area, but no one else was supposed to be in there and all that stuff. But I guess in real life, you know, he took it, took the information over time. So he was doing it on a consistent basis for a period of time, like days or weeks. I don't even know.
So this is just compressed down into one event for the movie then.
Right, yeah. And, you know, you have to have that dramatic scene, like you were saying.
Yeah. Okay. So you definitely felt that he was acting perfectly in concordance with the nap?
Yeah, because the information was being stolen from you and me. You know, you and I have no intention of somebody intercepting this. I mean, it may be a fact of life, just like when I went through the airport, I got, you know, gate raped. And, you know, as far as that goes, it was as pleasant as it could be, but it certainly wasn't a choice. It was just a matter of consequence that if I wanted to travel that day, that's what I had to do.
Okay. Right on. So what would you recommend the movie? What's your kind of like overall rating of the movie?
Well, you know, it's certainly not like blockbuster movie material as far as like you're going to go there and be entertained. But I think it's an important film to see. I think that I haven't watched Citizen Four yet, but I will, and I think that it will complement it. And so my recommendation at this point until seeing it is to others, you know, check out both.
And see it in the theater so that maybe more movies like this get made or, you know, so that this movie does well?
You know, that's an interesting question also because does that play a role in whether movies get made, do you think, as much as it used to? For example, I know that Super Troopers, what's that?
You're asking if a movie's box office matters whether or not more movies like that will get made?
Well, I know in the past it has, but I'm wondering if in the future that's going to continue because I know a lot of movies that bond at the box office get kind of a cult status in the you know aftermarket, like in DVD or VHS sales way back in the day. So they kind of gain a wider appeal over time because the box office is less important these days.
Well, in one sense, I think you're right. That the movie will, you know, enjoy a long life, have long legs after the fact, but that doesn't necessarily play into whether more movies of that will get made, especially by that particular creative group, because you need to make your money back while, you know, everybody's still alive, while everybody's still of a certain age, they can continue,
right.
You know, before they move on to other projects and get involved in other things.
I don't know if you're familiar with a movie that I'm a fan of, but also was not a box office success, and that is Super Troopers.
I'm familiar with Super Troopers. I am. That's where they're trying to sneak in the word meow into a whole bunch of conversations, as I recall.
Yeah. And as much as, you know, cops have been getting a bad rap lately and we're not a fan of false authority and things like that, but, you know, it's a movie and it's characters and whatever. But it did not do great at the box office and it came out, what, like 10, 15 years ago now?
And they're making a Super Troopers 2, though, right?
They are right now.
Right now. Same group.
And what they did was they did an Indiegogo and raised the funds. They needed to raise at least $2 million to be able to make the movie. And then if they got more than that, then they could add additional effects and other cool things, additional actors, whatever. They funded up to the $2 million by day number two.
Well, right on.
And they maintained the campaign, I think, for a month. And I don't know what they ended up making overall. But, they're making the movie. They're shooting it right now. So it's just an example of, you know, box office doesn't necessarily correlate any longer. It used to, sure. That used to be the only area you'd see it. You know, did it bomb the box office? All right, they're not going to make another one of these pieces of shit.
Well, yeah. I would say in general that's still true. I think if there's such a thing like what you're describing, I think that that isn't necessarily very common. Like, you know, for example, James Cameron, you know, the first Avatar made like $1 trillion or whatever. And so now he's making...
Which is a terrible movie, by the way.
Well, he's now making like 4 sequels because he made a ton of money.
Yeah.
You know, and the Transformers movies keep getting made. They just keep making more of those because each one makes like $1 billion. Or at least they make money. They make a profit. So people keep working and keep doing it. And I think, you know, if this movie does really poorly, it can just easily get swept under the rug and forgotten. And there will be no national discussion. There will be no outrage. As there really wasn't at the time. I think the opinion was divided at the time. That half people thought he was a criminal and a spy and, like, totally betraying and, like, compromising as if he, like, you know, released, like, the knock list or something from Mission Impossible 2 where all of a sudden all our secret agents are at risk or something for being exposed. I think that was, like, a Valerie Plame thing, wasn't that? I don't know. But, I don't know.
Yeah, she got exposed by government, I think. Wasn't that the thing?
Right. She was exposed, and she was all pissed about it, as you know, rightfully so or whatever, and then nothing happened. And that's another, you know, government is never held accountable for any of its crimes. maybe one person will get ratted out and thrown into the bus, maybe. Not even that super rare. 9 times out of 10, absolutely nothing happens. Despite all the outrage, all the rightful outrage, nothing ever changes. And
yeah, that reminds me of...
Well, we just need to change the government a little bit to work better. It's just ridiculous. The idea that you vote every couple of years or every year or whatever and expect anything different to happen, any of the tyranny to get reined in, instead of just accelerate further and further, is a joke. And I
so are you walking back on your previous comments where you said that there was a link between people being outraged and wanting to lie about something and politicians heeding to those demands? Or are you modifying it?
Love to make laws. That's what they're good at. What they're bad at is being held accountable for those laws. They will happily make a law, make a new law. They'd love to do that shit. Holy shit, are you kidding me? Aggress against somebody? Love it. But when it comes to being held accountable for those laws, they're like, what are you talking about? I'm just one guy in this whole machine. I didn't do anything wrong.
Right, okay. So what do you think that, I mean, I know you haven't seen the movie, but you know enough of the story at this point and the lack of outrage that has happened. Like, what would you want to see happen?
In regards to this movie?
Yeah, the revelations that were made. I mean, I think that you and I and people of our ilk were always kind of suspicious of these types of things occurring, you know. There were often times where I'd be, like, aware of where my phone was and, like, maybe take the battery out or whatever.
Yeah, we used to do that when we would have conversations. We didn't record them and put them up on the internet for everybody to listen to. So we actually took the phone batteries out and had conversations about this kind of stuff.
Right, and this is well before Snowden did his thing. I mean, this is, you know, 6, 7, 8 years ago now, I'd imagine. And I don't know necessarily what we were hiding. I mean, we weren't conspiring to do anything bad, but we didn't want to, you know, be listened into, eavesdropped on. And now we're sort of opening, you know, like we're welcoming it in a way. Like we're saying, okay, we're going to take our conversations, add a little bit of plugs for Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom into it, and pretty much have the same conversation, but then post it to the internet. Or click on the Amazon links below or whatever.
Right.
Or go to readit4.me and sign up for a free trial.
Smooth, Daniel. Smooth. Well done. I don't really know exactly what I would hope would happen. Like I just said, you know, regardless of the indignation, I mean, millions of people were against the Iraq war. Millions of people are against the Afghanistan war. The thing just continued. I mean, millions of people were against the Vietnam War. In some kind of magical fairy dust world, the government would come out and say, whoa, yeah, you're right. All of a sudden, we're doing all this stuff. Here, let me post this legislation that totally curbs in all our horrific actions. What does that do? That doesn't do anything. That's not going to stop anybody from doing any of that stuff. My ideal is that people walk away and stop supporting government. Stop talking about it. Stop, you know, talking about it in a way that is positive or in any way that government can do a thing or ought to do a thing. Stop paying your taxes. Stop. Just walk away. That's what I ask. Just walk away. Stop supporting it. The system would just collapse. They would just fade into forgotten memory, just obsolescence. And that's one of the interesting things about technology, as technology is able to do more and more things. Because that's one of the arguments, right, for government, right, is that they provide necessary services. And they couldn't possibly be handled by anything else. Couldn't be possibly be handled by the free market. Couldn't possibly be handled by anything else but government. So as government becomes more and more obsolete through technology, that hopefully people will just eventually forget about it. Just don't vote. Just don't pay taxes. And just live your life. Agorism.
Yeah, right? I think I sent you a video about how vitally important voting was. That was just kind of, you said,
oh,
you made about halfway through,
so,
people were retching.
Yeah, so for those who don't know, stupid Joss Whedon, Avengers, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Firefly director, came out with this vote in order to see Mark Garofalo. Is that the guy's name?
Mark Ruffalo?
Ruffalo. Mark Ruffalo's penis. And then if you vote, you get to see his wiener. And then he'll be naked in his next movie or something like that. It's really nauseating. You have these teary-eyed actors who are just talking about how important it is and how you have an obligation and a duty to vote for Hillary Clinton. And it is so disgusting. And luckily, some of the comments down below of the YouTube video were appropriately, you know, this is a bunch of propaganda bullshit. And the movie, the video did have a whole bunch of dislikes, which was good. But it smelled really bad, that video. I mean, was it really? I mean, there have been stupid voter-type things in the past, like Puffy Combs had a voter die thing a bunch of years ago.
Yeah, like or Rock the Vote, the MTV thing.
Yeah, the Rock the Vote. There have been a bunch of different kind of movements to get out the vote, usually almost always for, you know, some Democratic candidate, whoever it happens to be. This seems to be the latest one, and it also seems to be the lamest and most anemic one. But, I mean, all those things are just disgusting. It's all just disgusting. I mean, all these people just want something. They want...
I think Puffy, P. Diddy, whatever he's called now, Sean Combs, he later, after making that vote or die thing, said that voting was a waste of his time.
Really?
A few years later. And I think he was taking the, you know, because he's a black person and bad shit happens to black people or whatever. So he wasn't taking the voting is immoral. He was just taking the, well, I don't get anything out of it.
Right. I'm in the minority and I can't violently impose my will on anybody else, so never mind.
Yeah. I mean, you know, fact check me on that. I don't totally remember exactly how that all happened, but I just remember there was a bit of irony because he did the vote or die, and then a few years later it was like, ah, voting's a waste of time. Because he's right about that.
He is right. Also immoral.
So I have heard an argument recently, and you actually used it with me a few years ago when there was that GMO labeling thing, and that was defensive voting. Like, all right, they're going to vote to take more money away from me. I can say no, and if enough of people say no, then they won't take that money from me.
Yeah, it's a pragmatic argument, I guess. Are you arguing that the NAP supports this?
Well, yeah, I think the NAP would, because you're basically saying, hey, in this one arena where you're giving me like some limited, minute amount of opportunity to say no, don't aggress against me, I can do that.
Okay, so this reminds me of a Stefan Molyneux argument, where a little bit of violent aggression prevents a greater violent aggression, where he argues that we should close the southern border with America and Mexico, and you'd be violently preventing Mexicans from entering America in order to prevent the larger violence of Mexicans voting for an increased welfare state. So the two arguments strike me similarly in that you would be voting, which is a command, to forcibly tell the government to, what did you say, remove the lower taxes?
Yeah, well, the example locally here is that I see a bunch of signs saying vote yes for parks. And so, you know, your taxes will go up to pay for that park.
I see. So you'd be like Ron Paul.
Defensively, I could say, no, don't take more money from me and don't build a fucking park.
Okay.
Which I think is a little bit different than, oh, yeah, you know, build a wall to prevent people from coming in, which I think they're a little bit different, though I can see some similarity, like you're saying.
Yeah. There are nuances. I still think it legitimizes the system regardless. Even if you do, you know, log in just to vote no, which is, I suppose, in a self-defensive way. But then you can also use that to argue that, well, I'm going to vote for Clinton self-defensively because I think Trump is a greater threat to me. And that's
That was that Eric Peters thing, like, but opposite, like he thought that Clinton was going to be worse or something, so he's saying that he would prefer Trump.
There's always some kind of justification saying that, well, I'm going to vote defensively. I'm going to vote for the lesser of two evils because it's defensive.
Yeah.
I still think the vote is a command. It legitimizes the system. And it tells politicians that there are people out there that want you to rule over them. It is a request for domination. I mean, again, if someone wants to go out there and vote no against having their taxes raised, I'm not going to yell rail about that. That's so far down on my list of things to worry about, people voting defensively, that, you know, it's really a minor quibble, kind of. Although, I would say that it legitimizes the system. And I think the more that we can just walk away, like no matter how much they vote to increase our taxes to pay for some piece of art or whatever, the real answer is just walk away. Just don't pay them. They come, the tax collector comes to take the money. You go, you're a thief. Get away from me.
Yeah, or find a way to go through the loopholes that they provide. You know, like I sent you some things about Puerto Rico, where if you reside there, you can get your tax rate down significantly, like down to like 4% or something, which, you know, they're still stealing from you, but a significantly lower amount.
Yeah, that Puerto Rico stuff is very interesting to read. If you want to reduce your tax burden, which everyone has, I think, an obligation to. You have an obligation to yourself and to how much you value your own time and effort to reduce the amount you're stolen from. So absolutely, check out ways to, if you still want to, you know, survive, because it's also a pragmatic argument. Hey, I don't want, you know, men with submachine guns to show up to my door, which is what the fucking IRS does. They send teams, SWAT teams, essentially. They don't do it all the time, but they've done it. Yeah, check that out, Puerto Rico. You don't even have to reside there, is that right? You just have to set up some sort of company and then kind of filter all your money through there, is that right? Or set up some sort of an investment fund?
No, there's quite a few requirements that are necessary to meet in order to qualify for the tax rates there versus being taxed in the U.S. I think that whatever Peter Schiff was able to do meant that he didn't have to live there himself, but I think that for many of the many of the options that are there, you have to like reside there and have it be your primary base of residence and of business. I don't know if anyone were interested in looking further into it. You know, Simon Black, he's got some pretty good general information about it, but you probably want to, you know, speak with an attorney to make sure that you don't do anything improperly and end up on some kind of a list.
Even though you're probably already on a list.
Yeah, even though.
Yeah. Well, that was an interesting discussion, Daniel.
Yeah, you know, I thought I might have had a little bit more, but we've probably been on here long enough to qualify as a show. So if we want to start wrapping up, you want to give us an update on the things that you've been working on?
Not necessarily. Work continues. I might be where I'm currently at. I mean, it sounds like I'm going to be here through the winter. Work continues, but I am painfully slow. So it's frustrating. Me, but the way it is. It's going to be really good when it's done, though. So I'll look for that.
Yeah, well, that's cool. Well, hey, I got to mention, not just for the podcast, but for you, the Tom Wood stuff is actually really good. He breaks it down to the very building blocks, his course on government. So I highly recommend that you check that out if you can somehow. And, you know, same with the listeners. I think it's really good stuff. It's a lot of content. It's something like 90 lessons, and they're each roughly a half an hour. And there's reading assignments, and there's reports or writings that you need to do. I mean, I haven't been doing any of that stuff. I've been doing the listening stuff while I've been traveling. But, you know, it's good stuff. So check it out.
Check it out. All right. Tom Woods, interesting fellow, seemingly. Maybe I'll see who that is.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big fan of his and also of Larkin's. Larkin is a more in-your-face, you know, call them the bastards that they are, and Tom's a little bit more cordial, maybe a little too cordial sometimes, but he's a good resource.
He definitely knows the arguments. He's been doing it for a long time. He has a deep economic background, really knows his stuff, and yeah, he's awfully nice sometimes. He doesn't necessarily take his interviewees to task as much as I would like, but it's hard to argue with the guy's amount of material that he put out.
Yeah, indeed. Well, hey, Robert, thanks for joining me, especially at the last moment here. Today is the day that we're due to post the show, so here we are wrapping it up now. We've been the Reed Rothbard Podcast. We run ReedRothbard.com. We've got a Facebook channel, facebook.com/ReedRothbardClub, a bunch of lectures and books and articles, this podcast, a bunch of other stuff, ways to support us, all that other, I don't know, it just goes on and on. The list keeps getting longer.
Yeah. Support us if you can, if you think, you know, if you think this is a worthwhile source of entertainment / information, it'd be fantastic. We'd really appreciate it.
Yeah, we got a lot of ideas in the old heads here, the old noggins that we think will provide a lot of value. So if you've got anything that, you know, just ways of encouraging us to push on is helpful. One other thing I wanted to ask you, Robert, is I posted a video of a bunch of memes, a bunch of Murray memes, and I set it to some music. It's like 3 or 4 minutes long, and it turned out really, really nice. Have you had a chance to check that out?
I'm vaguely remembering you send me something like that. I don't think I was able to watch it at the time. if you could resend that, I will definitely check it out. It might take me, you know, like a half an hour to load, but I'll check it out.
All right. Sounds good. Well, thanks again, folks. Appreciate you joining us for this, the 20th, I think, episode of the Reed Rothbard podcast. My name is Daniel, and my co-host, as always, has been Robert Johnson. So good night, folks. Thank you very much.
Take care, everybody.
Chipmunks. Chipmunk. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do, 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 do.